My name is Eva Marie, and I'm here to make a name for myself. So leave the memories alone.
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered history!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat!
Delete!
You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Welcome to episode 507 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, August 6, 2017. I am the Sala Monster. I want to say thank you to the good folks at Audible who continue to support this podcast by providing our listeners a free trial of the Audible service, free for 30 days. Use our link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. You get one free audiobook of your choice, and a lot of you have been cashing in on the Justin Roberts book. I'm still getting some great feedback on the interview I did with him a few weeks ago. It's up on YouTube right now, and so definitely check that out. And if you use our link, you can use it on any book you want. It doesn't have to be Justin's book. It could be Shawn Michaels. He's got a book up there. Stone Cold, Steve Austin, Daniel Bryan, Chris Jericho. A lot of good ones up there right now on Audible, so definitely take advantage of that and help out the show. Also, if you want to help out the show, you can make a PayPal donation on thesalamonster.com. Right-hand side of the page, you'll see the PayPal button. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here. Hey, John Luzcana Lopez, thank you, as always. Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Ladies Man Levi Daly, Adam the Maniac Massaglia, haven't heard that name in a while, Mass Grave, Micah Harshaw, Raymond the Mountie Medina, who of course was the first one to pick up the new Solo Mountie shirt in our Pro Wrestling Tee store, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Prince of Pleasantville, Anelio Crockett, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker, Max the Axe Volato, Million Dollar, Matthew Yanez, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Super Mario Medina, Rochester Ruff, Victor DeLeon, the Main Attraction, Jackson Scott, Better Than Raw, Robert Michalczyk, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel T, Joe War Machine Waring, whose son Logan turns 2 here today, so happy birthday to young Logan, the Norwegian Nightmare, Paul Singso, thank you very much for your donation this week. Got some first-time donators. We also have the Bavarian Brute, Patrick Wagner, Dark Sky, Dixon Krasinski, Colossus, Carlos Cruz Jr., who celebrated a birthday on Friday, so happy belated birthday. It's easy for me to say. Happy belated birthday to Carlos. Thank you for the support. The Lake George Lunatic, Bobby Blanchard, who has authored an epic fantasy book called The Roar of a Dragon. Available right now in paperback or ebook format on Amazon, Goodreads, or at rowanvalebooks.com. That's under the name Robert Blanchard. And shout out to his son, Christian, by the way, who may be listening. What's up, Christian? Very cool of you to tune into the podcast. You know, I sometimes wonder, I was thinking about this, if the day ever does come, God help us all, that there is a little Sala Monster. I wonder, you know, would I let him watch the current product? I'm talking WWE. Like, would I let him watch the current product, or would I use the network and start him out like I did, watching all the old stuff that I did going back to, like, the mid-80s? Like that mid to late 80s WWF period. I think that'd be kind of neat to start him young on the old stuff. You know, they'd have no idea. They wouldn't know that it's old. And just sort of watch his reaction to all the stuff that I grew up on. I mean, at some point I would let him watch the current stuff. It's not like he'd be banned. I mean, maybe I'd ban him from watching Raw. But, you know, I'd let him watch the current stuff at some point. I mean, I don't know. Is that weird? I guess it's a little weird. Has anybody else tried this? I'd love to hear from somebody if they've actually tried this before. That's one of the benefits of having the network now. You have all of these old shows. I mean, I guess the one thing is you don't have the week-to-week Superstars and Wrestling Challenge. They still don't have that stuff up. But I was thinking about that, and I actually thought it would be kind of neat just to see, you know, see him watching all those old larger-than-life stars that I grew up on. I mean, I suppose it might be a problem the first time he tells me that he wants to go to one of the shows. I mean, imagine watching Hulk Hogan, like, at his peak, the Macho Man, Mr. Perfect, like, all these colorful characters every single week, and then going to the show and seeing Jinder Mahal and Baron Corbin. That would be quite the disappointment, wouldn't it? Yeah, I guess that would be. We have a meetup taking place in Brooklyn, SummerSlam weekend, if you are not already aware, Saturday, the day before SummerSlam, August 19th, beginning at 2 p.m., at the KBH, the King's Beer Hall. It's only a few blocks away from the Barclays Center, so if you are attending the NXT TakeOver show that night, it's only a few hours before. It's very convenient. You can come to the meetup, even if just for a few minutes. Drop by, say hello, and it's literally, what, 4 or 5 blocks, I think, away from the Barclays Center. You go over there and you enjoy the NXT show that night. So hope to see all of you out there. We have the invite is up on Facebook. I've posted it in a lot of different places. I posted links on Twitter as well, but you can find the invite. It's on our fan page on Facebook, the Solid Monster Sounds Off fan page. Please RSVP if you can, even if you only think you may be able to attend. I'm just trying to get a sense of how many people may show up. So I hope to see you all there. I mentioned before the new Solo Mountie shirt that's up in our Pro Wrestling Tee store. There's actually 2 new shirts. I am proud to say that the very first Mama Monster shirt, which a lot of you were asking about, and that got me thinking, and a very talented fellow by the name of Steve, shout out to Steve Mello for helping me out with the designs. So the first of what may be more, but the first Mama Monster shirt is in fact up in the store. I know she's very excited about that, and thank you to everybody who's been asking about her. It's not been an easy week, but that certainly put a smile on her face when I showed her I sent the link to the actual page. Like, once she saw that it became a reality, it became real, she thought that was kind of neat. So anyway, those 2 shirts, actually 3 technically, because the Mama Monster shirt is up in 2 different colors. You have the white shirt, and you have like a light blue. I did think about light pink, but she hates pink. So I said, okay. But I suppose if there were enough people who wanted it in that color, I could probably get it up. But anyway, white and blue versions of that are up right now. It's all up on prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. Please go and check those out. So I guess we kind of have to start here. It is the end of an era. You heard it at the top of the podcast. It is truly the end of an era. Eva Marie officially announced her farewell to WWE this week after 4 years with the company, much of which was spent not being on television, which is kind of what makes me laugh at some of the people who have emailed me or tweeted me or even on Facebook have kind of stuck up for her and said, oh, you know, you're not going to miss the way she looked and all this other stuff. It just makes me laugh because she's not been on TV. What's to miss? They signed her back in 2013. She was a star on Total Divas. Really, she was never a star on WWE television, if you think about it, because she never really had time to become one. For all intents and purposes, she was a performer on Total Divas who happened to start wrestling. That's kind of how I look at it. She only spent a little bit of time in NXT, a little bit of time on SmackDown before disappearing. Her whole gimmick on SmackDown was having her come up with excuses on why she couldn't wrestle every week. That was the storyline. 1 week, she had a wardrobe malfunction. The next week, she had a Charlie horse in her leg. I don't remember all the other excuses. It worked in that it was getting heat. I don't know if it would, you know, be the kind of heat that makes you want to pay money to go see her. You know, when all you need to do is sort of, if anybody has a working internet connection, you can see plenty of her. But that was her gimmick for a while until she got suspended for violating the company's wellness policy. After that, we never saw her again. I believe that was her last appearance on SmackDown. It's now been 1 full year. That's how long it's been since she's been, you know, really on TV. It's been a year. As soon as she got that part last year in that Nicolas Cage movie, looking back now, that really was, I mean, you could say the suspension was maybe the beginning of the end, but I look back when she got that part in that Nick Cage movie, and you could kind of tell she was starting to or hoping to branch out beyond WWE, and that really was the beginning of the end. You go back to February of this year, she removed all mentions of WWE from her social media pages. That was another red flag. last month, she was booted from the next season of Total Divas. That was another sign of what was coming. And then on Friday, she officially, you know, announced her departure from the company. And again, you know, I said before, some people were bent out of shape that, you know, I made reference to her not really doing anything of any real note during her run, which is true. She didn't. She really did not. You could say, well, you know, come on, she had some heat there for a few weeks out of 4 years. That's what you consider doing something. I was just making a comment, looking back, what did she really do? And the answer is really nothing. The fact that she's, you know, really attractive is all well and good. She is. She's hot. Absolutely. But guess what? There's plenty of hot women on that WWE roster. Right? She ain't the only one. There's plenty of photos of her online if you want to go look at her, because if you watch SmackDown, it's not like you saw much of her on TV anyway, so I really don't see what the great loss is here. I mean, seriously, she was never on TV. I don't get it. When she was, she started to embrace the hate, and they had her incorporate that into her character, which could have been fun to watch, but then she got suspended and never came back. So I say lots of luck to her in whatever she chooses to do. But I'm sorry, this is no great loss. You know, the world will continue spinning on its axis. And believe me, 6 months from now, nobody will be thinking, man, I sure do miss Eva Marie. I sure do miss that woman. There'll be five other women for you to look at in her place. WWE Network wanted to make mention of this. There's lots of shows getting the axe, unfortunately. And yet, Bring It to the Table lives. It's kind of weird. But they're in major cost-cutting mode, the company is right now. You could probably tell by the fact they haven't had pyro at their shows in many months. Some people really hate that. I know Noah Mark is certainly no fan of that. I really don't care. Either way, pyro, no pyro, I don't give a shit. This company has problems far larger than some sparkles in the air. I mean, really, get over yourselves. But, you know, and I get that some people think it makes for a bigger deal and everything. Believe me, WrestleMania will have plenty of pyro. The big, big, big shows will have at least some pyro. Do we need pyro on Raw and SmackDown every week? Do we need a violent explosion at the beginning of every show? No, we don't. This company has other issues that they need to address. And believe me, if they fixed a lot of the holes in their product right now, they could never have pyro again, and I wouldn't care. So I think it's a lot of people making a lot of noise about something that really isn't all that important. My opinion. But they're cutting back expenses in a lot of different areas. And the network, unfortunately, is one of them. Now, I watched that first season of the Edge and Christian show, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was very entertaining. I thought some of the stuff they got away with. And I even made the comment then, I don't think Vince McMahon really pays attention to most of the stuff on that network, at least in terms of the original programming, because if he did, half the shit these guys said and did never would have made the air. So that's kind of what made the show so fun. It felt like it was flying under the radar with some of the key people in the company. And these guys were just being allowed to really go out there and produce their own show. And they were very entertaining. And I was looking forward to a season two. It looked like Edge maybe wasn't going to do it. He said it's a lot of work. It's a lot of time. And then a few months ago, he confirmed that they were working on a second season. And I was pretty excited. And now apparently they've got half the season shot and the show's been canceled. They just made the announcement on the Edge and Christian podcast that, at least for now, season two, it looks like, has been shelved. It has been put on ice. That sucks. That's one of those original shows on there I actually was looking forward to. We know Talking Smack, although perhaps for other reasons, but nonetheless, Talking Smack week to week, canceled. R-Truth, they had R-Truth film a pilot, apparently, for a new game show. I have no idea if it's like an in-studio game show or like a man on the street type of thing, but whatever the format was or would have been, it is no more. The plans for the R-Truth game show, I guess even after the pilot they shot, canceled, dead, done, before it even saw the light of day. And who knows what else they may have shelved or plans they may have put on ice that we don't even know about, because I'm sure they're always drawing up plans for new shows and new programming. So that, to me, way more than, you know, pyro, I mean, for God's sakes, is what really I find to be really disappointing. But at the same time, you know, they're underperforming from where they were last year in terms of certain business benchmarks, and this is what they feel they have to do. Those network shows, they cost a lot of money. They really do cost a lot of money. It may not seem like it, but there's a lot of expense that goes into it, and I get that. You know, they made a business decision. It's just a shame that, you know, I can't sit here and tell you how many people actually spend $9.99 on the network just for shows like that. I mean, how many people buy the network just for the Edge and Christian show, just for Table for Three? I mean, maybe there are some, but I'm willing to bet you that the large majority of people who spend money on that network are not spending it for the Edge and Christian show. You know, they're spending it, they're probably spending it for the pay-per-views. You know, they're spending it for the original, like, in-ring programming. Or, in some cases, they may be spending it for the classic stuff. But even the classic stuff, apparently, doesn't really do all that great. Which is probably why they've been in no rush to upload the weekly Superstars and Wrestling Challenge and all that stuff. And hopefully, in time, they will. That's really what I want on the network. Right now, that and some of the old Coliseum video stuff. They can just create a whole library on there just of those old videos. And in time, I'm sure all that stuff will make its way over. But I don't think that this is the last that we're going to see. My big question is, they're cutting costs in all these different areas, right? So they're cutting costs in terms of pyro and programming. What about talent? You know, I made this comment on the podcast several weeks ago that WWE doesn't really fire people. You know, when the Austin Aries thing went down, and there's still a lot of debate about whether or not Aries asked for it, if the company just fired him because he was difficult to work with. I think there's some truth between, you know, both of those things where he was unhappy. He was not unhappy to have been told he was being released. Either way, I made the comment at the time. I said, you know, when you really think about it, all these like post-WrestleMania periods that there used to be, spring cleaning, these, you know, Black Friday, they'd fire 10 people at once. You don't really see that anymore. You know, I saw the announcement that Ho Ho Loon, the Chinese star who was part of the Cruiserweight Classic, they signed him to a contract a while ago. He got his release this week, not because they fired him. He asked for it. He requested his release. There's a personal family situation, I guess, going on back home, and hopefully everything's okay there. But even in a case like that, they didn't fire the guy. He had to go to them and say, look, I need out, and they let him go. You don't really hear very often about them firing people. So I'm wondering if now, if they're really in a hole, and they're trying to cut costs in any way, well, one of the easiest ways to cut costs is to cut the dead weight that you're not using. You're paying these people. Will they start cutting people? That's what I'm curious to see. So that'll be something to follow here in the next few weeks. Is if they do that, if they start cutting people, they must be way behind as far as their benchmarks go. If they have to actually start firing people because they really haven't done that in years. Saddest tweet, by the way, now I'm talking about the network here, the saddest tweet of the week came from at WWE Network on Twitter. So I forgot if it was like Tuesday or Wednesday, whatever it was. I'm sitting there, I'm going through my timeline on Twitter, and I see a tweet that says, relive WWE Battleground 2017 in its entirety, starting right now on the award-winning WWE Network. Relive! It was traumatic enough living through it the first time. Relive. You should have seen the comments, by the way, under this tweet. I got a nice belly laugh out of it. Just comment after comment. I was looking for a positive comment, like, oh yeah, I can't wait to watch Battleground. Not a single one. Just one comment after the other. People just incredulous that the network would even suggest that they go back and watch that show in its entirety. I can't even fathom such a thing. Monday Night Raw from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania this past Monday night, the home of the Raw GM, Kurt Angle, who got a nice little hero's welcome walking out at the beginning of the show. Raw Twitter poll, over 2,300 votes, 35% thumbs up, 65% thumbs down. Uh-oh, the streak of thumbs up shows is over. Really was a very difficult show to sit through. Because after that triple threat match, which they put in the middle of the show, you know, it was just Raw's snore, Raw's bore, Raw's a chore. I mean, come up with whatever word you want to use for it. It was not a fun show to sit through. Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman showed up to give Kurt Angle a piece of news at the beginning of the show, and that is that if Lesnar loses the Universal title at SummerSlam, both Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman will leave WWE. They find it very unfair that Brock can lose his title without even being pinned, that he has to defend it in a four-way. Heyman says it's obvious that Kurt is trying to get that title off of his client, and should he succeed, they will walk out together. Now, obviously, what they're doing here is they are playing off of all the rumors of a UFC fight between Brock Lesnar and Jon Jones. The fact is, you know, as some of you have even pointed out, Brock Lesnar is being advertised for shows, for tapings in the fall, you know, between now and Survivor Series. In fact, as the days go on, as we speak, some of these arenas are posting new announcements on their websites and on their Twitter pages saying, hey, Brock Lesnar has been added to this taping. Brock Lesnar has been added to that taping. So you see that. And the fact that, look, nothing's changed. This guy is under contract until WrestleMania next year. He is under contract with them until April of 2018. He is not going anywhere. Doesn't mean he can't lose the title and then play off the fact that he really is gone and then 2 months later pop back up on TV again. But that's all this is. This is a storyline. And I think it's smart because they know people have heard. People saw Jon Jones challenge Brock. They see the news stories out there and they're probably wondering, hey, is this really going to happen? I do think the fight will happen. Not anytime soon. Not in the next, probably not even this year. It may well happen after his contract is up. But I do think it'll happen. But the fact is that, you know, I said a few weeks ago, I think it would be a mistake for WWE to let Brock walk away at the end of his contract. Even if he does want to fight Jon Jones next year and they have that big fight. You know, Vince let him fight while he was under contract once before. That should not stop them from making another deal. Brock, you know, I know there's a lot of hate for the guy out there, and even I'm kind of sick and tired of some of the stuff that he does, but Brock is unlike anybody else that they have on that roster. And there is still plenty of guys that he hasn't worked with who, you know, I'd like to see him in the ring with some of those guys, be it on Raw or SmackDown, or maybe even some guys coming up in NXT. You know, if he sticks around long enough, Brock may have a chance to work a whole bunch of those guys. I'd like to see that. And I hope they can reach a deal. I hope they can keep him around for at least another couple of years. We did have a triple threat match with the other three men in the Universal title match at SummerSlam. Roman Reigns, Samoa Joe, and Braun Strowman. I enjoyed it. Nothing too special. But, you know, save it for SummerSlam. Don't give it all away here. I wouldn't expect these three to go out there and have a 20 or 25 minute knockdown drag out, because then you take some of the shine off the match at SummerSlam. Roman won with a spear on Samoa Joe, so unfortunately Joe can no longer say that he has never been pinned by Roman Reigns. He has now, in fact, been pinned by Roman Reigns. But, you know, first we have Great Balls of Fire, and now this. For a guy in Joe who had a lot of momentum and still does, you know, eating the pin here in these two matches now, I sure hope this leads to a win for him at SummerSlam. Rumor this week, which is all this is, by the way, is just a rumor, but the rumor was that Paul Heyman has been pushing behind the scenes for Joe to win the championship at the pay-per-view. Again, I'm not sure how true that is, but if it is, I'm with Heyman. I'm glad Heyman agrees with me. They also put this match on in the middle of the show, which I thought was very odd, especially when you look at how this match ended, which was a clean win for the babyface, who I guess people don't really see as the babyface, but he is. But a clean win for Roman at the end of a, you know, probably the longest match on the show, I would guess, this was. You look at the way this match ended, and you look at the way the actual main event ended. And you ask yourself, why the hell was this in the middle of the show? I don't know. I'm going to get to that main event. Tomorrow night, by the way, they've already announced it will be Roman Reigns versus Braun Strowman in a last man standing match. That's tomorrow night on Raw. Jason Jordan was the guest on Miz TV. I watched part of this with my hand over my face, kind of peeking through my fingers. This could have been really bad, but it wasn't too bad. I thought Jordan did okay for himself. The crowd didn't turn on him, even though the Miz asked him at one point, what's it like getting booed by the crowd? Which was very weird, because the crowd wasn't really booing him. It's so cringy. It is so cringy when they try to lead the crowd like that, and then inevitably, it backfires on them. It's so embarrassing. But that's sort of what happened here. When Miz started insulting Kurt, he started insulting this guy's dad. That's when Jordan got real angry. He got in his face. He said, look, you can say what you want to say about me, but say another word about my dad, we're going to have trouble. When Miz finally came at him, Jordan gave him an overhead belly-to-belly suplex into the rest of his entourage, knocked them all down, and then he ran away. He ran away from the Miztourage. That was, I wouldn't have done that, but anyway. So, I it sure seems like they're setting up an Intercontinental title match at SummerSlam between these two. I saw the note in the Observer this week that the match may be bumped off the show, not because they're giving up on Jason Jordan or any of this other nonsense I've seen on some websites. If in fact it is bumped from the pay-per-view, it's only because they have too many matches planned and they want to give this more time to build. I'd say that'd be a pretty good idea. Yeah, how about that? How about giving this thing a little more time to build other than, 2 weeks? What the hell do you need to rush this for? Seriously, does this match need to be on the SummerSlam card? Does everybody have to be fit, you know, perfectly and neatly onto every major pay-per-view? Come on. Especially, it's a split brand show. You've got Raw guys, you've got SmackDown guys and gals. So you're not going to be able to get everybody on the show anyway. I understand Miz is a champion and maybe they want every title to be defended, but to me, it's not necessary. It's you can build this up. You know, they've got a Raw pay-per-view a month later. Save it for that show. Now, if anything, they could have Miz send either Bo Dallas or Curtis Axel out there on the kickoff show. Maybe they want to do something on the kickoff show and, you know, pick a member of the entourage and let them get their ass kicked by Jordan. Let it be a display for Jordan to go out there and suplex them around and do a bunch of stuff. You know, Jordan, if I were doing this, Jordan should have to go through each member of the entourage in a singles match before he gets to The Miz. Then after he beats them both, you could do a week where he has to wrestle them both at the same time in a handicap match. Like, there's ways for you to really drag this out and put heat on Miz because, you know, what is this guy afraid? Is he afraid of Kurt Angle's son? And it just makes him look like more of a chicken shit every week he tries to put that match off. And so you could do that. The problem is, I guess I don't trust them to come up with interesting stuff for him to do for another 6 weeks just to get to No Mercy. I think that's what it is, right? No Mercy. I just don't have the faith in them to do the right thing with Jordan, which is to have him go out there and kick ass instead of having him talk too much. But I would suggest, you know, you can mix in a few random squashes even for him over the next few weeks, you know, beyond just wrestling Axel and Dallas. Maybe have a week where they air a video package, like they did in NXT once. They had this great American Alpha video package. It probably was before one of their pay-per-view matches, I don't remember. But it showed, like, because both of them have an amateur wrestling background. Gable, obviously, is a former Olympian. He sort of failed in the Olympics. And I just remember this video package. They showed when Gable lost, how it just broke his spirit. They talked about Jordan. He had lost, I think, a big match, I don't know, in college or something. And it broke his heart, but they fought back from adversity and they hate losing. It was a great video package. And I think something like that should air on Raw, should air on TV to give people a better sense of who this guy is. We know he's, quote, Kurt Angle's son, and he used to be part of that tag team on SmackDown. But beyond that, what do people really know about this guy? They said he's a three-sport athlete. Okay. They didn't even tell us what sports. We assume wrestling. They may have mentioned baseball. I don't remember. What's the other one? I assume football. I don't know. They haven't told us. So they could even, you know, kill a week by giving us some more background on this guy. Bray Wyatt came out to cut a promo on Finn Balor. Started talking about how there is no escape for you. No mortal man can escape the darkness. This is me now when I hear a Bray Wyatt promo. It's always the same drivel. It is always the same. Balor suddenly did appear with his back turned to Wyatt, and as Wyatt came at him, he gave him a Pele kick, so that was kind of cool. Yeah, I mean, look, when I first saw that this was the direction they were going in and they were going to have a match at SummerSlam, It was kind of neat to think about Bray Wyatt. He's got this dark character right against the Demon. I think it still could be cool. But again, every week that Bray comes out and cuts that same promo, I just can't take the guy seriously. And he's won a few matches now. He's actually won a couple of big matches recently. They've done that much damage to this guy where I just can't take him seriously. Elias Samson is, in fact, now simply Elias. Remember last week I said on WWE.com his profile was changed. They took his last name away, and we would find out on TV this week if, in fact, he was going to go by one name. And there's your answer. Vince McMahon has murdered yet another last name. We've got a serial killer on our hands here, folks. He pinned Kalisto with his finish that he now calls Drift Away. Like his last name just sort of drifted away. Bayley and Nia Jax had a match, and it turned into something of a disaster. Bayley suffered a shoulder injury during the match after Nia violently threw her out of the ring, and in doing so, Bayley first crashed to the mat before rolling out to the floor. She seemed to be okay after that, but then a few minutes later, Nia had her up in a double-arm chicken wing with her arms trapped behind her, and when she threw her down, instead of landing flat on her face, Bayley landed right on her shoulder, the same shoulder that she had hurt earlier, and that is where the injury seemed to have happened. She immediately rolled out of the ring. The referee went to go check on her. Now, to her credit, she continued the match. I don't know how smart that was, but she wrestled another 2 or 3 minutes, whatever it was, but clearly was in a lot of pain. She really didn't have a whole lot of use or mobility of that arm. She could barely throw a punch. There was also a really embarrassing spot where Bayley was in a seated position. Nia went to drop an elbow, I guess on the back of her neck or whatever, her spine, but she missed. Bayley is literally sitting there. All Nia has to do is drop an elbow, and she missed. And the announcers, they tried to cover for her, but my God. Bayley ended up winning by count out. Alexa Bliss had run down. Bayley fought her off, and Nia came charging at her. Bayley sidestepped her, so Nia ran into the steps, and in doing so, Bayley got back into the ring just in the nick of time to beat the count. This was really bad. I mean, the match was bad. The injury, looked bad. On WWE.com after the show, they showed Bayley with a trainer. They said that they were waiting a few days for the swelling to go down. This woman was in tears. I mean, you could tell she was crying. She had been crying. Her makeup was running. And so they said, we're going to have to wait to get an actual diagnosis here, and we'll get x-rays, and we'll find out the extent of the injury and how long she may be out for. Now, the latest update is that they're going to reevaluate her at Raw backstage tomorrow night, and so I guess we'll have more information at that point. If it turns out to not be serious, they can certainly turn it into a storyline and incorporate it. I mean, either way, they've already acknowledged it on their own website, so they're going to have to talk about the injury tomorrow, even if she's good to go. I'm sure it will be sort of incorporated here into the build-up to this match with Alexa, and now Alexa can target the shoulder. The hope for her is that she can even go at SummerSlam, because if this is a legitimate injury and there's any significance to it, even if it's just, hey, you got to be out for 4 weeks or 6 weeks, that takes her out of SummerSlam. So Sasha Banks may end up getting her title match with Alexa after all. I mean, I wish the best to Bayley. I hate seeing anybody hurt, but if she can't go in time for that pay-per-view, the story sells itself. You book a Sasha Banks match with Nia Jax. Pray for Sasha, by the way, if you put her in there with Nia. But you book that match on Raw for the number one contendership. Sasha wins, and then tries to avenge her best friend's injury by taking the title from Alexa at SummerSlam. In a Falls Count Anywhere match. I'm not going to let this go. I still think that should be the SummerSlam match anyway, and we may still be able to get it. The main event on this show, if you can call it a main event, was Big Cass against The Big Show. Yes, that was the main event. Enzo Amore was out to introduce The Big Show. They had a 5-minute match with a DQ finish. Hell of a way to end this show. This crowd in Pittsburgh, if you checked their pockets and you gave them a cavity search, you would not have been able to find a single fuck to be given. They did not care about this at all. Cass won by DQ when Enzo jumped on his back. And once he sort of shook him off, Cass booted him in the face yet again. and then got caught by Big Show with the knockout punch. They both collapsed to the mat at the same time. Big Show ended up carrying Enzo to the back with him. This sucked. Everything about this sucked. Plain and simple. This would have sucked if it opened the show, let alone the fact that it closed the show. The more I watch the booking of Enzo Amore here on this show week to week, the more I believe the stories about him having heat with people off camera. I wasn't really sure about the story of him getting kicked off the bus by Roman Reigns, but the stuff about him being full of himself, rubbing people the wrong way, that I believe. Even on that Bring It to the Table show they just did, they actually brought up the subject of Enzo reportedly having heat, and Corey Graves flat out said, I don't really like Enzo. I don't really like the guy, he said, but look, I want him on Raw. I want him on my team because I know how popular he is with the fans. I know he sells a lot of merch. And so, you know, if it's like Raw versus SmackDown and I'm on the red team, I want this guy on my team. But, you know, Graves did admit, he said Enzo is super annoying and he feels he would be best positioned on 205 Live. That he could really help boost that show. I still maintain that his real value is on the main roster as a manager for someone, not as a wrestler, because as a wrestler, he is absolutely terrible. And that was in a tag team where you can actually hide some of the guy's weaknesses. Now he's on his own. It's even worse. The other idea being talked about is that the best thing for him would be to get him away from Vince McMahon and send him back to NXT because he can really help sell tickets to some of the live events. He's still very popular down there, you know, in front of that Full Sail audience. There are people in that company who actually feel getting him far away from Vince McMahon, the owner of the company, by the way, will help save his career. My question is, how do we get the rest of the roster away from Vince McMahon? Can we do that? One other note, after the show on WWE's YouTube channel, they posted a backstage interview with Matt and Jeff Hardy, who were doing a lot of the broken phrases, obsolete, and all this, without actually calling themselves broken. Instead, Matt referred to themselves as woken. They are the woken Hardys. I just got done talking about this a week ago. Matt is a very creative guy, and it's time that he comes up with a plan B. Keep fighting the good fight against Anthem. I hope they win, and I hope they get all the broken stuff back and they can use it at some point. But that's not happening anytime soon. That much is obvious. And I know it was a collaborative effort. It wasn't just Matt, but, you know, the basis of that whole character and story, you know, my understanding has always been that, you know, it was a Matt Hardy idea that with the help of a lot of different people at Impact, he was able to make a reality. And you know, some of the people who were writing for the show back then and Jeremy Borash, again, it was a collaborative thing. But Matt has always been a very creative guy going back to the Omega days. Ask anybody who's ever worked with him. Well, guess what? It's time, I think, for Matt Hardy to work that magic again and come up with something new as a way to sort of stick it to Anthem and say, the hell with you, we don't need you. We're going to fight you. We're going to sue your ass. We're going to take you to court and then let the chips fall where they may. We're not just going to roll over and give up, but we're moving on. You're not going to hold this over our head for the rest of our lives. Now, the woken thing, that's not overly creative. I mean, that really is an F you to Anthem, if they can get away with that. I'm not so sure that they can't get away with that. They may be able to. I mean, when it comes to copyright and trademark and stuff like that, you know, every case is different. It's very possible that he may be able to get away with calling themselves woken and staying away from the actual term broken. Or maybe Anthem just wouldn't put up a fight over it. I don't know, but I don't see the woken stuff actually coming to TV. You know, maybe I'll look like an idiot this week if they come out and the announcers start calling them woken. But believe me, WWE is not going to put them on TV and let them do that unless they're very confident that they are not ruffling any legal feathers and that they can get away with it. So I guess we'll see tomorrow night if there's any actual reference on camera. There's a big difference between doing that on TV and doing that on a YouTube video. That's sort of the key. They were on TV this week, the Hardys were, but they didn't do this until after the show, backstage. So that's sort of the key. But, you know, Matt is in this promo talking about how I feel revived and I feel triggered. He actually used that word. He's like, I feel triggered. Maybe that's the gimmick. Triggered Matt Hardy. You piss him off and he just snaps. Basically doing a Rebby Hardy gimmick. SmackDown Live from Cleveland, Ohio, Twitter poll. Much like Raw, also over 2,300 votes. Very consistent vote tally there. This was quite the different story. 89% thumbs up, only 11% thumbs down. SmackDown, the resounding winner this week between the two shows. And why not? They open and close with two really good matches, and in between, sort of like the vanilla cream in the Oreo, they had another really good match with Rusev and Chad Gable. To me, that's an easy thumbs-up show, especially when you look at how Raw ended. I mean, my God, between that and the Bayley and the Nia stuff, I mean, the triple threat was good, but not that good. So yeah, I'd say that SmackDown is the easy winner this week. Plus, also, if I may say so, when it comes to SmackDown, the Usos are quite great. We've now seen them do two things we've never seen before with New Day, which is attack them as they made their entrance and sort of leave them laying. I don't ever remember another team in all the years New Day has been around being attacked, like attacking them in the middle of their big entrance. So we've seen the Usos do that. There's a violent attack on TV the week before. And this week, they tried to fool everybody, and they did, I think, for a few seconds anyway, by doing the Big E intro backstage, you know, where Big E, you know, he kind of starts out the intro. Well, the Usos impersonated him, and they came out, and they got lots of heat for it. And then they rapped on the New Day. I thought that was also very well done. The Usos are killing it right now. I hope they get those belts back. I never would have taken the belts off them so soon anyway, but hopefully at some point soon they're able to get them back. Kevin Owens got his rematch with AJ Styles for the United States Championship. No Chris Jericho on this show. Apparently his return last week was a one-off for now. We had a hilariously awful referee bump where Kevin Owens went to punch Mike Chioda. And Mike Chioda, you know, God bless him, he's been a professional, he's been around for so long, you would think he would know better, but Mike Chioda is in there, and what this reminded me of is the infamous ref bump in TNA, which I still think is the worst bump, probably the most cringe-worthy bump I've ever seen, at least by a referee. The one where Bully Ray picked up Bobby Roode for a powerbomb. He was going to powerbomb Roode, which he did, through a table. Roode's foot, apparently, was supposed to catch the referee in the face. I think the referee might have been Brian Stifler. But I guess in picking Roode up, the idea was that Roode's foot would strike the referee inadvertently in the face, and the ref would take a bump. But the referee was nowhere near his foot. So he quickly realizes, the ref does, that, oh, I fucked up, and he proceeds to sell anyway and fall down. It looked like he had a brain aneurysm and just collapsed. So, Chioda is down here. Now, this was not as bad, but that's kind of what it reminded me of. Chioda, anyway, takes the bump. He's down. He's not out, but he's down. AJ rolls up Owens. Chioda crawls over, counts the three, despite the fact that Kevin Owens' shoulder was clearly a good 6 inches up off the mat. Another shit finish in what I thought was, you know, a pretty decent match here between these two. Owens went backstage, he blew a gasket in front of Shane McMahon and Daniel Bryan. Shane admitted, look, you got hosed, I agree with you, calm down. I'm going to give you a rematch with AJ Styles for the championship at SummerSlam. Owens would not shut up, he's still very unhappy. Bryan then butts in, he says, you know what, we're going to make Shane McMahon the special referee. You want to make sure that you don't get screwed over again by a referee? Fine, Shane will be the referee. So that's their way of getting Shane on the SummerSlam card without him having to wrestle. I still would not mind seeing Owens and Shane, like in a street fight. I think the two of them could have a fun brawl. I assume that he counts the fall for AJ. Hopefully that ends this feud with AJ and Owens. I mean, at that point, what's left to do? So hopefully that'll end the feud. And then Owens can blame Shane for the loss, and that leads to a match between them at the next SmackDown pay-per-view. Which I think that might actually be Hell in a Cell. God, I hope so. I hope there's not another SmackDown show until then. Just because there's so many. I mean, is there a SmackDown pay-per-view in September? There probably is, right? Who am I kidding? Of course there is. Call it Revenge of the Maharaja or something like that. Brazongo's latest Fashion File spoof was on the old TV show Twin Peaks. I say old because I think, didn't they reboot that? They're rebooting everything now because nobody has an original idea anymore. But I'm referring to the old show from the 90s. I never watched Twin Peaks when I was younger, so I didn't get any of the references here. Fandango apparently is still missing after he was dragged away by some mystery men at Battleground. I wish some mystery men had dragged me away from Battleground. We had, or women, we had a dream sequence where Tyler Breeze was seeing things that weren't actually real because the Ascension showed up. One of them, I think it was Connor, was pouring maple syrup on a wooden log. Kevin Dunn was surely salivating at the sight of this. Fork in hand, napkin neatly tucked into his shirt. Fandango was there, even though he's really missing, so this was basically a dream sequence. And by the way, the funny thing about this is the whole storyline is that Fandango is missing, right? He's been missing since the pay-per-view. It's a few weeks now. How much you want to bet? I haven't checked the recent house show results, but how much do you want to bet that he's probably been on all of the SmackDown house shows since the pay-per-view, which is just, I get it's house shows and everything. Shut up. You know what? It's still stupid. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they've actually kept him off those shows. But I don't know. With their track record, I wouldn't be surprised if he was there every single night. Anyway, when this segment ended, I guess Breeze woke up. It was to be continued. So the storyline continues. Eric Rowan has been kept off the show lately, as has Luke Harper. So perhaps it does end up being Harper and Rowan. I just think that's so lazy. It's just... It's, you know, I'm a fan. I like Luke Harper. I really do. And I just think it's such lazy BS if he just ends up back in a tag team with Eric Rowan. It's just an admission of failure, not on the part of Luke Harper. It's an admission of failure on the part of Road Doggy Dog or whoever the fuck is writing that show these days that they just, you know, they failed with this guy. They had something there and they didn't know what to do with him or they felt that there wasn't a spot for him. And so they failed him. That's how I would look at it if they just end up putting him back in a tag team. I'd rather they just call somebody up from NXT. The problem is, you got a big tag team problem down there as well. So, I don't know what they're going to do. Aiden English got a shock win here over Sami Zayn. Very brief, like, two-minute match. You know Maria's husband is just dead when Sami Zayn can routinely beat him, but Sami loses to Aiden English. Speaking of Maria's husband, he and Maria walked out to their music when the match was over to rub it in Sammy's face. Maria literally said one thing. I think it was something about the power of love. And then they hit their music and got them the hell out of there. It was like, wow, that was awfully quick here. This guy's not even getting any TV time, let alone any big wins. Rusev and Chad Gable. This was really fun. I enjoyed this match a lot. Gable hit multiple overhead belly-to-belly suplexes on Rusev, which is impressive, because Rusev is quite bigger than Gable. Crowd was really into this, too. Gable nailed a very Kurt Angle-esque moonsault on Rusev for a near fall. Not only did he hit a Kurt Angle-esque moonsault off the top rope, he applied an ankle lock to Rusev. Kurt fathered the wrong kid. There's been a grave mistake made here. Rusev ended up winning with the accolade. A fine showing for Chad Gable, even in defeat. After the match, Rusev was complaining about not having any real competition. He demanded an opponent for SummerSlam, and out walked Randy Orton. The good news is that this means no more Randy Orton Jinder Mahal matches, and more importantly, no Randy Orton Great Khali match at SummerSlam. Thank God. Instead, it's basically Orton against Rusev in a battle of the guys who have nothing better to do at SummerSlam. Hey, we don't have anything for these two guys. Let's just put them in a match. And poor Rusev. This guy comes back. His very first opponent is John Cena. And I say poor Rusev. There's a couple of ways to look at this. You could look at this and say, well, Rusev got a pay-per-view match against John Cena, right? That was probably second from the top of that card. And now he's going to wrestle Randy Orton, another top guy in the company at SummerSlam. He gets, you know, two pay-per-view paydays out of it and gets to wrestle two of the biggest stars in the company. So yeah, That's one way to look at it. That's true. I look at it a little bit differently. I look at it from the perspective of Rusev was out for months and months and months with an injury. They took Lana away from him. They have cut this guy's balls off at every opportunity for some weird bullshit that may have happened backstage or whatever. 2 years ago, it seems like this guy has been on someone's shit list. He comes back. He's got no woman anymore. So now he's on his own. And it's not like Lana's doing much better without him. I still scratch my head at why they had to split them up. Even if Lana wanted to wrestle, you can't keep them together and have Lana start wrestling. There was something, there was somebody who didn't like them and probably just took every chance they could to stick it to these two. Whatever their reasoning was, they're now each weaker for being apart. So that's bad enough. Rusev comes back, and his very first night, out comes John Cena. They set up the flag match. You knew how that one was going to end, and he loses. So now we go to SummerSlam, and now he's going to wrestle Randy Orton. This guy goes from John Cena to Randy Orton. A guy, by the way, in Randy Orton, who has now lost, what, 4 straight pay-per-view matches, I believe? He lost the House of Horrors to Bray Wyatt. He lost 3 straight matches to Jinder Mahal to help put that guy over. Orton is overdue for a win. I would say Rusev's chances right now don't look too good at SummerSlam. So when I say poor Rusev, that's really what I'm talking about here. I'll be honest, after the match they had on TV this week, even though Rusev beat him, there was really no ambiguity about it. He got him to tap out in the middle of the ring. I would still much rather see Rusev against Chad Gable in a rematch at SummerSlam than I would Rusev against Orton. I really liked the match those two had on TV this week. I thought they had good chemistry and they gelled together. And there's just something cool about watching a smaller guy like Gable go in there and just overpower some of these guys. Or not even overpower so much, but just sort of muscle them up and throw them around. That guy's the real deal. You know, I mean, he is the real deal, and I'd much rather see that match. But Orton and Rusev it is, I suppose. By the way, I was talking about winning and losing before. And just this notion, and we've heard this a lot from people like in WWE. I think Road Dogg maybe on Twitter a while back tried to make this argument, or did make the argument. And Sean Waltman, I think, had something to say on Twitter about Curt Hawkins' 100-match losing streak. And I didn't see exactly what he said, but somebody tweeted me and said, what do you think about Waltman and Road Dogg and all these people talking about how wins and losses don't matter? And I just sort of laugh. I laugh for a few different reasons. I laugh because, number one, Waltman himself, and that's why I'm not sure what Waltman said exactly about Curt Hawkins. I'd have to see it in context. But Waltman is the one who did an interview not that long ago. I covered it here on this show, where he said one of the problems with the product is that wins and losses should matter. So that sounds awfully bipolar of him to say something like that. So I don't know exactly where his head is at on that issue. I'll go back and see exactly what he tweeted the other day. But, you know, clearly at one time anyway, he felt differently. And the idea that wins and losses don't matter is just such bullshit. And it's an easy cop-out answer for people who perhaps in some cases, in some positions who work for that company, who just can't be bothered to make things make sense, or whatever their reasoning is. You know, you can, not to say that you can't lose a match and it doesn't kill you, like losing a match here and there is not that big of a deal, but the idea that, well, winning and losing doesn't matter, it's a different time in wrestling now, right? It's a new era where wins and losses don't matter. It's such a crock of shit answer. I honestly can't think that people like that who have been doing this for so long honestly believe that. I really just don't think they do. But if they do, boy, that doesn't really bode well, I think, for the product. If they honestly believe that even today, winning and losing just doesn't matter, you could certainly point to examples of a lot of people, whether it be a Brock Lesnar or a John Cena or the Undertaker streak at WrestleMania, and you could probably come up with other examples where, you know what, winning a lot meant a lot for those guys. So what made those guys so special that it can't apply to the guys today? Maybe that's part of the reason why a lot of the guys today don't feel so special. Look at Braun Strowman on Raw. They've made a legitimate, genuine new star in Braun. Now, Braun's lost a couple of matches here and there. He even lost to Roman Reigns. But by and large, what does he do? He goes out there, he smashes people, and he wins. And rarely does Braun go out there and lose. And they've created in this guy an attraction that can probably make them a lot of money. Then you look at a guy like Bray Wyatt, who still could be a major attraction and potentially can make the money at some point. But I give, you know, I'll use him as exhibit. I mean, you could probably use Dolph Ziggler as exhibit A of what they've done to that guy over the years. But Bray Wyatt, exhibit A. I said, I can't take this guy seriously anymore. Why? Because he would go out there, he would cut these dark promos, and every single time, he would come up on the losing end at the end of that feud, whether it was with Orton, or Cena, or whoever. He would always come out on the losing end, so his words felt hollow. He wasn't backing it up. People love somebody who talks trash and then goes out there and backs it up, whether it's WWE, UFC, life, right? The bully in the schoolyard, whoever it is, you're going to talk shit. You better be able to back it up. Not in WWE. You can talk all the shit you want. It don't matter whether you back it up or not. That doesn't make any sense. Not if you want people to take that guy seriously and to pay money to see that person. The guy's a fool. So don't tell me that wins and losses don't matter. I don't care if it's 1987 or 2017. There are some things, there are some constants that don't change, even as other things change and the product evolves, and I'm not saying it's the end-all be-all, but don't give me this bullshit that wins and losses don't matter, because you know that's just not true. Anyway, I'm all riled up now. We had the first ever meeting between John Cena and Shinsuke Nakamura here on this show. Speaking of wins and losses, this is another great example. To determine who would face Jinder Mahal for the WWE title at SummerSlam. Mahal and the Singh brothers watched from up in one of the skyboxes. Cena came out first, which I liked. Made Nakamura's entrance feel like a bigger deal with him coming out last. They had a good match. Not a classic by any means, but I enjoyed it. It was a solid TV main event here between two guys who have never wrestled each other before. But it had a big time feel to it. There was a buzz in the crowd. Nakamura got to kick out of the AA, which I know everybody does these days, but still, he got to kick out of it. Cena went for another AA late in the match. Nakamura slipped out. He went for an exploder suplex, which we've seen a gazillion times in Shinsuke Nakamura matches without incident. A move that he has used many times before without any problems against Sami Zayn, against Finn Balor, against a bigger guy like Baron Corbin. Never any problems. Until now. He picks up Cena, and John Cena, I know Nakamura was very apologetic to him afterwards, but this looked 100% like John Cena's fault. Cena looked like he thought maybe he was taking a back suplex and not an exploder. It's not a move he's used to taking from people. And so he didn't get the full rotation. Because, you know, there's a lot of cooperation in these moves. I mean, I guess, you know, you can never really say it's 100% someone, well, I guess you can actually sometimes say that, but it takes two to tango, that's true. But again, I'm watching this and I'm just thinking, man, this guy's not getting the rotation, this is going to end badly. And sure enough, he landed right on the back of his neck. Because normally, you know, you'd get the rotation, you would land on your chest, right, face first, you would land flat on your face on the mat, but he didn't rotate enough, and Nakamura dropped him right on the back of his neck, his surgically repaired neck. Cena folded like an accordion. All of his weight, all of his 250 pounds or whatever he is these days, came down right on his neck. Nakamura immediately realized what happened. He looked very concerned. I'm sure he was for lots of different reasons. I'm sure Vince McMahon broke out in a cold sweat backstage on headset. Referee checked on Cena. He seemed to be okay. He was a little slow in getting up. Nakamura had a stall for a little bit as he was getting ready and set up for the Kinshasa. But Cena got up, and he nailed him with it. He nailed him with the Kinshasa, and he got the pin right in the middle. 1, 2, 3. And this finish here reminded me of the SummerSlam match with John Cena and Daniel Bryan, where Bryan nailed him with a running knee. In fact, Bryan took that move from Nakamura. Nakamura, at one point anyway, was Bryan's favorite wrestler. I remember him doing interviews where he flat-out admitted, the person who I have the most fun watching, and this is going back about 4 years now, the person that I have the most fun watching in all of wrestling is this guy, Shinsuke Nakamura, who at the time he might have been the, I don't know if he was already the Intercontinental Champion over there in New Japan or not, but I at least was aware of who he was by that point, and I agreed Nakamura really was a lot of fun to watch in New Japan, and Bryan for so long was pushing for that match. In fact, at one point he was pushing, he actually thought there was a chance that WWE would be open to doing some sort of an interpromotional match with WWE and New Japan and simulcasting that one match on the network as a network special. I think the network started in what? I think it was February of 2014. So it was sometime after that. But this was an idea that Bryan himself pitched, and it never happened. And one of the reasons Nakamura signed to come to WWE, he said, was for a match with Daniel Bryan. So when he found out Bryan had to retire, he was very upset about that because that was one of the reasons he came here in the first place. So talk about a match that got away from us that we'll never get to see. I mean, never say never, I suppose, right? If Nakamura ever goes back to Japan and Daniel Bryan ever gets out of that contract of his, never say never. He probably should not take that match, but I can't sit here and say 100% that it'll never happen. But anyway, long story short here, that's where Bryan got the move from, and so maybe that's why it reminded me of that finish. It was basically the same exact finish, and John Cena ate the clean loss right in the middle of the ring, put the guy over huge. Big pop for the win, too. Nakamura was very clearly upset. He mouthed, "I'm sorry," to Cena when the match was over, and Cena, to his credit, said, "Don't be sorry. Don't be sorry," and he raised the guy's arm. That's a class act right there. If I were Nakamura, I would apologize too, but that it really did not look like his fault. I'm just, from my perspective, it did not look like his fault. Cena's very lucky, though. He's very lucky he did not get seriously hurt, especially with all the things this guy has planned. You know, I saw this week, he just nabbed a role in the next Transformers movie. I think it's a spinoff, like Bumblebee or Bumblefuck or whatever it's called. He's lucky not to be laid up with a broken neck for the next 6 months after what we saw here. But they did the right thing, and that is a huge win for Shinsuke Nakamura. Again, don't tell me that wins and losses don't matter. Don't tell me that a clean win in the middle on TV against John Cena is not a big boost for this guy's credibility. Because it is, and it's a huge endorsement from the company. It's a huge endorsement for him that he beat John Cena, A, and B, they're putting him in one of the main events at one of their biggest shows of the year. A clean win like that was not the original plan, as leaked accidentally on WWE.com. I think it might have been Aaron Rift of No DQ who first grabbed the screenshot. There was a write-up that was posted very briefly on WWE.com and then got taken down. A very different description of the end of that John Cena Shinsuke Nakamura match. Maybe it was Cena versus Nakamura in some alternate dimension that they were reviewing here on WWE.com. But their version, the description that some poor writer over at .com had written up, had Baron Corbin interfering to cost Nakamura the match, but it backfired somehow, and according to what was written, it helped Corbin's, quote, nemesis pick up an incredible victory over John Cena. So, there's a great example, right? Plans change. In this case, though, you know what? They changed for the better. I don't know who made that call, if it was Vince, if it was Triple H, if it was someone else, but whoever it was, kudos to them, because they made the right call. Corbin did come out, but he came out after the match. They aired some bonus footage on WWE Network before 205 Live started. Corbin attacked Nakamura in the ring. John Cena ended up coming back and giving Corbin an attitude adjustment through the announce table. And then John Cena again raised Nakamura's arm and left. And sure does look like, first of all, it looks like it's going to be Cena against Baron Corbin at SummerSlam, which if they do that match and Cena wins, to me, that's all but a guarantee Corbin's coming back out to cash in. Now, is he successful? That I don't know. But that'll be something to watch for in the outcome of that Cena-Corbin match, because to me, there ain't no way that Corbin loses and doesn't come out to cash in at the end of the show. But if I had to make an early prediction, though, for SummerSlam, I would hate to see them waste Nakamura's first title win by having him win and then 2 minutes later lose. I don't like that. I don't like that idea. I would have Corbin cash in and lose. We don't have enough failed cash-ins. Just a matter of percentages. We've had John Cena actually failed. He was the first one to fail, although that was part of a storyline. Damian Sandow failed in more ways than one. Who else? That was the only two I could think of. I don't know of anybody else who's tried to cash in and not won the championship. So for that reason, and the fact that I don't want to see, well, there's a couple of things. I'm done with the Jinder Mahal experiment. I know their reasons had to do with India, and they're going to do all this business in India, which apparently they're not even doing. So to me, the Jinder Mahal thing, you know, he's got a good thing going with the Singh brothers, right? He's certainly a bigger star now than he was 6 months ago, but he's not doing it for me. And so I have no interest in continuing on with Jinder Mahal as WWE champion. I'd rather Nakamura just get the big win and get the big ovation and have them do that at SummerSlam. They could have Corbin cash in, but fall short. And it's not like, you know, he can't eventually come back and win the championship the proper way. But I really don't want to see that cheap win in this case. We see it so many times. And I just think that in this case, I don't know, part of me always looked at Corbin, even though he's a heel, I've never really looked at Corbin as being sort of the, I was going to say the chicken shit heel. It doesn't necessarily make you a chicken shit heel if you cash in on somebody who's just wrestled a 20-minute match. But I don't know, I always kind of looked at him as being somebody who would kind of get up in your face and kind of do things that way and not, you know, sneak up with the briefcase and win the championship the way that everybody else wins the championship. Maybe he is, you know, maybe the character is, but we'll see. But if I had to venture a guess as to what might happen or what I would do, that's what I would do. Part of it also is you have to think that people just assume if you cash in, you're going to win. People are already assuming that Baron Corbin is walking out as the champion. So it'd almost be a little bit of a swerve on them if he tried and then failed, because I don't think too many people would actually see that coming. Now, as far as John Cena goes, John Cena is being advertised for the No Mercy pay-per-view on September 24th, which is a Raw brand show. He is a free agent, after all. And he'll be on the road at most of the Raw tapings after SummerSlam, so he's going to Raw. Question is, who's he going to work with? Got Roman Reigns. He and Cena have been going back and forth on Twitter. I think it would be insane to waste that John Cena-Roman Reigns match on a friggin' No Mercy show. I don't care how much of Cena's time is going to be, you know, devoted to outside projects in the next 6 to 12 months. You can find a big pay-per-view to do that match, whether it's WrestleMania or not. You can find a more appropriate time and a more appropriate show to do the John Cena-Roman Reigns match. No Mercy is not the time to be wasting that. We already saw Cena Nakamura on TV. So, to me, to do Cena Reigns on that show would be insane. You've got Braun Strowman. Strowman had great chemistry with Roman Reigns. Say what you want to about Roman Reigns. The haters have to admit, the matches they've had have been pretty damn good. And it's not just a one-way street in that case. It goes both ways. So, would Strowman have the same kind of chemistry with Cena? I think it's a pretty safe bet, because John Cena is another one who I think, you know, he gets shat on a lot. Oh, he's not the best wrestler, five moves, blah, blah, blah. Fact is, his resume speaks for itself. Speaks for itself. Look at the pay-per-view matches this guy has had over the years with all of the big names, and even some names that are not so big. I'm not saying he's Ric Flair, who can work with anybody and go in there and have a great match, but he's had great matches with almost everybody that there is on that roster, including AJ Styles, Seth Rollins. I mean, we can go through the whole list of different people. Kevin Owens. I liked a lot of the matches he had during the U.S. Open Challenge with Sami Zayn and Cesaro. So, John Cena going in there and working with Braun Strowman. Braun is no slouch. Braun does not need to be led. He's pretty damn good on his own. I think the two of them probably would have a pretty kick-ass match. The one who I would go with, and some of you might throw this back in my face and say, well, if you're so adamant that they shouldn't blow off John Cena, Roman Reigns at a pay-per-view like No Mercy, then why would you do that with Samoa Joe? True. I could see Joe and Cena being a Royal Rumble match or a WrestleMania match as well, but Cena's got to work somebody. There's got to be a big name he's going to work. Clearly, the thing with Reigns, that's being set up for a much bigger pay-per-view. But if Cena's time is going to be very limited between now and next year, and he's not going to be around as much, then you know what? We need a big match for that No Mercy show. I would love to see John Cena and Samoa Joe. There's a history there. They came up together out on the West Coast. They could play off of that. They might even have some footage of that they can use of them. I don't know if they ever worked a match back then, but they were certainly in the same class. I know that. I've seen footage of them in the same class together. I think that was Rick Bassman's school. So there's a history there that they could even play off of. I see no reason for them to ignore that. But it's it's another match we've never seen before between, you know, these two big stars. I think that could very well be the match at No Mercy, and that's the match that I would love to see. I would love to see John Cena against Samoa Joe. So once he pops up on Raw, we'll see who he interrupts. I assume that's how this whole thing usually works, right? John Cena will come out and interrupt somebody, and that will be his opponent. We'll find out after SummerSlam who they match him up with. One more note on SmackDown. Daniel Bryan tweeted that Smacking Talk, which was the rogue replacement that he and Renee Young had come up with to Talking Smack, Smacking Talk has been shut down. It is no more. But we'll always have our memory of that one and only episode they did of Daniel Bryan telling us what a virile five-year-old he was for him to be the father of Chad Gable.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Only two more episodes to go before TakeOver Brooklyn 3. Johnny Gargano had his first match here on this show since splitting from Tommaso Ciampa at the last TakeOver show. He beat the debuting Raul Mendoza. You know him from the Cruiserweight Classic. Quick start here, a lot of fun reversals. This was by no means a squash win for Gargano. Mendoza looked good. Gargano won with the Gargano Escape submission, which is a chicken wing over the shoulder crossface. It's really too bad about the Ciampa injury because these two would have torn the house down in Brooklyn, and probably would have been, if you want to look at it this way, one of the, I guess the TakeOver shows really don't have that many matches to begin with. I was going to say the top three matches on this show would have been the NXT title match, the women's title match, and probably Gargano and Ciampa, and it certainly would have been a fun match to watch, I think, that would have gotten over big time in front of that crowd. Gargano now, though, doesn't even have a match on the show at all, as of right now. My guess is they tape a bunch of matches from the Barclays Center for TV to air the following week, and he'll make his way into one of those matches. That would be my guess. Asuka came to the ring in street clothes to tell everybody that Ember Moon is not ready for Asuka. That's a terrible impersonation, by the way. Ember came out, said the truth is Asuka is not ready for Ember Moon. And Asuka sort of laughed it off and stuck her hand out for a handshake, and Ember hesitated, but went in for the shake, and when she did, Asuka pulled her hand away, and then slapped Ember right across the face. Ember nailed Asuka with a forearm in retaliation, but Asuka fought back and threw her out of the ring, and as Asuka was showboating, they intentionally kept the camera off of Ember so we could not see her climbing up to the top rope to get ready for the eclipse, which she did nail. She laid out Asuka with the eclipse. The announcers made a big deal about the fact that if Ember hits that move at TakeOver, we're going to have a new champion. And it's a tough one, man. I'm telling you, it's a tough call, but I think the right call is keeping that title on Asuka. I really do. I mean, Ember is over. She is very popular. She's a really good wrestler. She got screwed the first time in there with Asuka, so it's not like Asuka beat her straight up. There's a lot of debate about whether or not, you know, can she or can't she get the fair win over her. This is her redemption. This is meant to be her redemption. By all measures, she should win the championship. But I just think there is more value in keeping that title on her even a little bit longer. I really think that she should drop it to Kairi Sane or just take it with her to Raw or SmackDown. But it's a tough call. I mean, if she loses it and they give it to Ember, I'm not going to say that that's a terrible decision, but I do think it would be the wrong move to make right now. Bobby Roode had a sit-down interview, brief sit-down in the back, talking to some nameless, faceless voice off-camera answering questions. He said Roddy, as in Roderick Strong, does not belong in NXT. He played the lottery. He played the Bobby Roode lottery, and he lost. And then he challenged Drew McIntyre, his opponent at TakeOver, to have a little sit-down in the ring next week on NXT. He abruptly ended the interview, at which point Roddy showed up. He tried to go after him. He had to be restrained. William Regal showed up, yelling and screaming at Roddy, not very happy. What do I have to do? What do I have to do to get Bobby Roode, is what he wanted to know from Regal. And Regal said, look, as far as TakeOver goes, the match is set. There's nothing I can do. And Roddy walked off. And if I didn't know any better, I would say they're almost setting up for Roddy to somehow inadvertently cost Drew McIntyre the championship at TakeOver, and it ends up with Rude retaining. That's kind of where I think this may be going here. But I'm going to have more to say about this here in a second. The Street Profits, which is Angelo Dawkins and I forgot the other guy's name. But anyway, they're going to make their debut on TV this Wednesday. Sonya Deville and Jenna Van Bemmel, a dead ringer for Charlotte. If Charlotte looked like she was moving through clay, she would be Jenna Van Bemmel, because that's where all the similarities between them ended, is just in terms of their looks, in terms of their face. Once the match started, that was it. That's where it ended. Because this woman looked like she was underwater, the way that she was moving around. But then again, she knew her job was just get her ass kicked and get pinned. So maybe that was part of the plan. I'll just stand here and move around really slowly and look terrible because I'm going to get beat and I got to make the other person look good. I don't know. But this woman moved around in there like she just woke up from a coma after 20 years. And Deville got the submission win with an armbar. It is scary, though. It is scary how much this woman looks like Charlotte, or at least the old Charlotte from NXT. I mean, I think she even has a mole on her face in the same spot that Charlotte does. Look at the side-by-side. I saw people doing this. Look at the side-by-side on Facebook between these two and tell me that that is not a dead ringer for Charlotte. And we know Ric Flair got around over the years. We know a lot of women rode Space Mountain. But this is just ridiculous. Hideo Itami was interviewed, backstage. Why should I respect Cassius Ohno when I get no respect in return? That's what he wanted to know. And all of a sudden, the interview lady disrespects him by cutting him off in mid-sentence and saying, "Oh, Hideo, I'm sorry. We have to go back out to the ring." She made it sound like there was some kind of an emergency, which is funny because Itami just took the microphone out of her hand and walked out to the ring himself, and there was nothing going on. They were just about to get ready for the next match. That was the big urgent reason for them to interrupt Hideo Itami. So that was weird. But Itami went to the ring with the mic, and he's a heel. I mean, there's no doubt about it now. He's in full-on heel mode now. Aleister Black came out for his match, and he ended up going face-to-face with Hideo Itami. And Itami was like, okay. He was sort of backing off. He made like he was just going to walk away. But he faked it. And when he tried to sneak attack Aleister Black saw it coming. And he knocked out Hideo Itami with the Black Mass kick. Knocked him out. And that's going to be a match, by the way, a takeover. It's going to be Aleister Black against Hideo Itami. Aleister Black had a match on this show here with the debuting Kyle O'Reilly. That was our main event. Now, Black had already beaten Bobby Fish. He already has one win over one half of Red Dragon. Now he can add the whole team to his list of victims with this win here over Kyle O'Reilly. But O'Reilly, even though he lost here in his debut, which is normally a Lucha Underground specialty, he lost nothing from this match. He looked good. In fact, this was the most competitive match, I think, that Aleister Black has had to date since making his debut, if we don't count... We don't count that random match he had as Tommy End on the UK special in January where they just sort of threw him out there as an attraction and he lost. Aside from that, he has yet to lose. He has yet to look weak in any way. And this was easily the most competitive match we've seen him in yet. This is a great match. Mauro Ranallo was in his element calling this match. You know that Mauro is the one calling the match when the name Kazushi Sakuraba is mentioned no less than 3 times in the span of 60 seconds. Black won with the Black Mass. O'Reilly, though, like I said, he gained a lot of credibility, I thought, in defeat here on this being his first night, especially with people maybe who didn't know who he was. I don't see how you come away from this match not being impressed or not thinking, hey, this guy got a lot of offense in. He must be something special. So I think it was a good night for him overall. Here's hoping they reunite him and Bobby Fish as a team. Because one thing about NXT right now is they are in dire need of new tag teams. The Street Profits are going to make their debut on Wednesday. That's great. TM61 should be back soon. I forgot if it was Nick Miller or Shane, which one had the injury. But they should be due back very, very soon. They've got Heavy Machinery. They have Riddick Moss and Tino Sabatelli. Even though they have that sweet Brock Lesnar deal, apparently, where they only show up 5 times a year. They're still a tag team. The pieces are there, but if you add in Red Dragon and maybe another team like Beyond Sanity and the Authors of Pain, you're gonna have a pretty damn good tag team division there. So it's not like it's a lost cause or something like that, or they have to start from scratch. They have teams, but they need a couple more, and I think you'll have a good number at that point. I think you'll have what you need. Now, PW Insider allegedly reported, I say allegedly only because I haven't seen the report yet myself, but this is credited to PWInsider.com. They reported that there has been discussion within WWE of putting all of the former Ring of Honor wrestlers in NXT or coming into NXT, putting them together as a faction down in NXT. Now, the report did not say who that might include, but take your pick, right? You've got Mr. ROH himself. Roderick Strong was literally called Mr. Ring of Honor when he was there. You've got him. You've got Adam Cole. Adam Cole has been, he's dropped off the face of the friggin' earth the last several weeks. Why do you think that is? There's a reason for that. Adam Cole is on his way in any week now. You've got Bobby Fish. You've got Kyle O'Reilly. We know Leo Rush and Donovan Dijak are on their way in soon, at least into the Performance Center, if not TV. War Machine, right? They've also been rumored to be NXT bound. There is no shortage right now of former Ring of Honor stars that they could use in a faction. I just don't know that I buy that they would actually pull the trigger and do it. But I'll say this much. I think it would be a great idea. I hope they do it. I like the idea of Adam Cole leading his own group when he comes in. Throw Roddy in there because I think he'd benefit from being around others and not on his own. And then you round it out with another couple of guys, maybe a tag team. I don't know that Red Dragon needs to be in there. But the idea of taking, say, four of those guys and making them a group would be pretty cool. In fact, with Roddy, this could tie in perfectly with the storyline that they have going. And maybe this is the direction they're going in. We just saw this on this show, on this very episode of NXT, how desperate this guy is to get his hands on Bobby Roode. He is desperate. And Regal said, I can't do anything. I'm sorry, my hands are tied. I can't do anything for you. Right? The match is Bobby Roode and Drew McIntyre. I'm sorry, Roddy. There's nothing I can do for you. Well, what if Roddy is so desperate? Doesn't have a match on the show at all right now. What if he is so desperate, he brings in some friends and they all attack Bobby Roode at the end of that match, at the end of that show. And they attack Drew McIntyre, too, as collateral damage. You know that in Brooklyn it would get a huge reaction. It'd get a huge reaction at Full Sail, too. But they could even show Adam Cole sitting in the crowd earlier in the show, right, to take over. Hey, it's Adam Cole. What's he doing here? We've seen them do that before with Asuka and Drew McIntyre and Bobby Roode. So I could see them doing that with Adam Cole in a couple of weeks at the TakeOver show. And so, well, they've already shown him on screen, so I guess that's it, right? That's the Adam Cole appearance for the night. But what if it wasn't? What if at the end of the show, he reemerges? He's part of the attack. Maybe he hops over the barricade or something. He joins in. He's part of the attack. He's leading the attack. And you've got this new faction of guys. You've got some new blood now. I like that idea a lot. That's how I would do it. The title of this week's Lucha Underground episode was The Hunger Inside. And this was the best wrestling TV show all week. Two great matches and a hot angle to end the show, all condensed into one easy-to-watch hour. I like it. Phoenix against Pindar in a quarterfinal match in the Cueto Cup. There was a monkey flip spot in here where Matt Stryker absolutely lost his mind on the height that Phoenix was able to get on this flip. Phoenix ended up winning with a double knee drop off the top rope, so he advances. There's an office scene with Dario Cueto in the Worldwide Underground, including Jack Evans with his jaw wired shut. He tells them, do not interfere in Johnny Mundo's match later in the show, which, of course, they usually do. If you don't, if you can control yourselves and not actually interfere in this match here, each of you will have a chance to win. And he showed a bunch of medallions sitting on his desk. This is all part of the whole gift to the... Remember the gift of the gods? You got to get the medallion and you put the medallion in the belt. Anyway, they'll all have a chance to win medallions if they could just keep their nose out of Johnny Mundo's business for one night. And they all agreed and they all walked out. We had Prince Puma against Dante Fox in another Cueto Cup quarterfinal match. This match was ridiculous. This was a ridiculous match. Insane what these guys were doing in there. It's hard to keep up. It really was. It was hard to keep up. Puma won with the 630 splash from the top. They had this great overhead shot of him as he landed the move. It just looked great. Awesome camera work on that spot. Puma now faces Phoenix, which should be a pretty damn great match, in fact, in the semifinals. This is a match that you either really loved, and I did. I really loved this match. You either really, really loved this match, or you really hated this match, because it was spot after spot after spot. I could see why some people would not like this match, but I can't hate on the things we saw in this match. It's just, I can't hate on anybody for that. It was just incredible stuff. I'm a big fan. Obviously, Puma is maybe one of the most talented guys in all of wrestling right now. He could do things in there that nobody else can. But also, I don't think that Dante Fox, AR Fox, call him whatever you want, he's a guy I was not really all that familiar with before I first saw him in Lucha Underground. I mean, I went on YouTube and saw some of his work, but I've become more familiar with him here on this show, and this guy impresses me a lot, and he doesn't really get talked about, I think, as much as he should, in the same vein as other guys like Puma, or a Will Ospreay, or people like that, but he should be, because he's very, very talented. We had a scene from the police station with Captain Vasquez and Detective Reyes, of course, the former Cortez Castro, who, as we later found out, has been working undercover as a cop. She was showing him footage of Cage with his gauntlet glove, his Nintendo Power glove. She wants the glove. I guess she's a gamer. And Reyes says, fuck that, I'm not getting anywhere near that guy, let alone trying to take that glove away from him. And he walks out. Smart man, Detective Reyes. Main event here on this show was Johnny Mundo against Dragon Azteca Jr. This was another excellent match, back-to-back here on this show. Mundo won with the End of the World and did so without the help of the Worldwide Underground. They stayed out of the match. Now, during the match, they made it a point to show us Rey Mysterio's family was sitting in the front row. So you knew something bad was coming, and it did. After the match, Mundo grabbed a chair. He started to beat on Dragon Azteca with it. He wrapped it around his head. He threatened to pilmanize him until Rey Mysterio ran out. He made the save. Mundo ran off. We thought that was the end of the show, but no. Oh, no. Mundo came back. Once he saw that Rey left, he came back down to the ring. He happened to spot Rey Mysterio's family in the front row. And he goes over and he sees Rey's son, Dominic. Yes, the same Dominic that Rey and Eddie Guerrero wrestled for custody of one year at SummerSlam. The kid now is what? He had to be, what, 8 years old probably back then? Something like that, 8 or 9 years old, I would guess. Well, he's a full 12 years older now, and he is training to become a wrestler. I know, what a surprise. The son of a wrestler is training to become a wrestler. No better way, by the way, to make you feel old than that. The fact that I remember when this kid was only 8 or 9, and now here he is. He towers over his father. I mean, my God, if you thought that this guy was going to look like his dad, at least in terms of height, it's the opposite. So Mundo starts talking to him. Hey, Dominic, you got real big, man. And then he says, you know, your dad ain't worth shit. That's what he said. That's exactly what he said. Didn't bleep it out or anything. He doesn't have a chance in hell of taking this title away from me. He got in his mom's face, Rey's wife. And that was just too much for Dominic to handle. He stood up. Mundo pie-faced him. This brought Mysterio rushing back out. But as he's running out, he got attacked by the Worldwide Underground. Since Dario Cueto didn't say anything about interfering in this stuff after the match. So Mundo threatens to hit him with the Lucha Underground title. They're holding Rey. Mundo's got the belt. He's going to hit Rey with it. But instead, he hits Dominic with the belt. Knocks him to the ground. All Rey could do was watch. This was great. This was just a great angle, great heat. They made the match personal now between the two of them. They're having a match for the championship in a few weeks. This was kind of a heavy angle to end the show here. Actually, the show technically ended with a segment outside. Phoenix offers to walk Melissa Santos to her car. These two, it's like puppy love here between these two. And Melissa ends up getting a piggyback ride from Phoenix. Lucky SOB. Hiding out nearby is Marty the Moth, because Marty would not be Marty unless he was creeping out somehow. So they're teasing that he's going to take Phoenix's mask off of him, because Melissa's like randomly asking Phoenix, do you wear that mask all the time? Like, it's such a corny question. It just sort of came out of nowhere. So I guess, you know, that was the impetus for Marty to say, well, I'm going to take that mask off of him and show him how ugly, show you how ugly he is. And so I guess that's his new goal now, is to get the mask off of Phoenix. But again, two excellent matches back to back, a heavy angle with Ray's family and attacking his son to end the show. This was a great episode. This was one of the better episodes of the season, I thought, of Lucha Underground. G1 Climax. Have some more thoughts on some of the events this week from the G1, even though I'm not fully caught up with everything. I did catch some of the important stuff. A warning here, if you do not want to know anything that happened in any of the G1 matches this week, if you're far behind or what have you, there's going to be some spoiler stuff in here, so I would advise you to skip ahead. Otherwise, I don't know what to tell you. Day 11 of the G1, as we roll on here, had Tanahashi against Kota Ibushi. This was the match I said last week. I was looking forward more to this match than anything else in the G1 coming up. Aside from maybe Omega and Okada, I'm looking forward to that as well. But again, second time now that we've seen Tanahashi in this tournament in a match where he's playing the heel. He did that in the match with Yuji Nagata. And thank you to everybody who clarified for me the reason that Nagata was so beloved when they had that match and they booed Tanahashi was because Nagata said that this would be his final G1. I mean, the guy is a legend, and so you're going to have people that just like him. But apparently he announced in advance that this is going to be his final G1, and so that's why he's getting those types of reactions now. Here in this match, they were in Kagoshima, Japan, which is the hometown of Kota Ibushi. And so Ibushi was super popular, and Tanahashi was booed. He played it up again because he's a pro, and he's smart, and he knows how to do those things. This was a great match. It started slow, slower than I thought it would be. This was not balls-to-the-wall stuff like some of these matches tend to be, like a lot of Kota Ibushi matches are. A lot of Tanahashi working over Ibushi's legs to ground him and slow him down. Not too much working over Tanahashi's arm. We've seen a lot of that already in this tournament. I'm sure we still will. We didn't really get a lot of that here in this match. And maybe that's part of why they started out so slow, is that, look, Tanahashi now, they're what, 12 days in now, 13 days into this thing, and he's had a whole bunch of matches, and it's easy to forget the fact that this guy has a pretty significant tear by all reports of his, you know, bicep muscle. He's out there with a sleeve on his arm, having matches like he's 100% healthy. But at some point, that catches up with you. And so maybe that's starting to take its toll. Maybe that's starting to catch up. But he's still out there having great matches like this one. It's amazing what this guy's able to do. They picked their spots. What they did, it really meant something. Ibushi hit a moonsault at one point to the floor. Tanahashi turned right back around, climbed all the way to the top rope, hit a high fly flow to Ibushi standing outside the ring. Ibushi hit the lawn dart throw that we've seen him do in a lot of his matches. Tanahashi just missed the bottom turnbuckle. Or like, I guess they don't have turnbuckles, the pad, the corner pad that they have. He just barely missed it. Basically, he lawn darted him and he hit the floor. He hit the mat. Still looked nasty. Sling blade. Tanahashi hit a sling blade. And Ibushi did the best sell job for a sling blade that I've ever seen. This was like an RVD level sell or Neville in that match in NXT that he had with Tyler Breeze, where Breeze hit a tornado. Remember when Breeze hit that tornado DDT on Neville? That is still the best sell of a tornado DDT that I've ever seen. He gave the guy a tornado DDT and Neville flipped, like landed. I'm trying to describe this. Landed on his feet. He flipped over, landed on his feet, and proceeded to continue to fall forwards and fell flat on his face. Go look that spot up. It was great. Makes me miss what Tyler Breeze is actually, you know, capable of doing when he's in there in a you know, a one-on-one match with someone. But anyway, Tanahashi went for a high fly flow. Ibushi got the knees up, hit the Golden Star Powerbomb. basically, which is, you know, last ride powerbomb on Tanahashi. But Tanahashi kicked out. He kicked out of the Golden Star. Or at least that's what Red Shoes said. Looked like Tanahashi waited a little too long to get the shoulder up. But the ref said two. Ibushi was in shock. He couldn't believe it. He brought Tanahashi up to his knees. And he caught him with a wicked knee strike. Kneed him right in the side of the face. And got the win. That came out of nowhere. I was not expecting that to be the finish. But this was a great match. And I'll tell you something. If we don't get Ibushi and Kenny Omega in the finals of this thing, then it has to be a match at Wrestle Kingdom in January. I did watch him use that knee strike here and thought, hey, he's using the V-trigger. So maybe a little subtle sign, maybe, that he's getting ready for Omega soon. Speaking of Omega and the V-trigger, that brings me to day 12. I wanted to mention the Omega match with Evil. This Evil guy, by the way, is pretty good. This Evil guy is no slouch. It's amazing, right? Somebody in the G1 is actually pretty good. But again, I haven't seen too much of him before this tournament. But he's pretty good. They had a crazy match. They had one table spot. I don't know why. I can't sit here and explain why wrestlers do the things they do. They're nuts. They're some of the craziest people in the world, what they put themselves through. And those tables in Japan, I mean, they're not like the tables here. You know, here, not to say you can't get hurt on a table bump here. But, you know, WWE, they go to Home Depot, they buy a bunch of, kind of thin, flimsy-ass tables. It's easy enough to put somebody through it, unless you're Sasha Banks. If you're Charlotte and Sasha Banks and you try to throw Sasha onto the table, through the table, you might have some trouble. Remember the Hell in a Cell match that they had last year. But the tables there, I mean, they're smaller, they're harder. These guys went through that table. I think it was Evil gave him like a, was it a Uranage? I think he may have given him off the apron through the table. And Omega took the brunt of it. It was not pretty. It's amazing that they both didn't kill themselves on that spot. Evil himself, who actually hit the move, came up bloody by the eye, all cut up. But it was later in the match, Omega hit a V-trigger that seemed to knock Evil loopy. His eyes were all glazed over. He looked like he was knocked out. He was conscious, but he was knocked out. And Omega might have sensed it, and he went for the pin, but Evil's arm was under the bottom rope, and so Kenny Omega, you know, the referee said, couldn't count the fall, and so Kenny Omega took this guy who was clearly not all there, and he had to know that something was off, because he's trying to pick this guy up, he's not moving, or he's barely moving. But he took this guy and put him up on his shoulders, which was a struggle in and of itself because the guy was practically dead weight. He gets this guy up on his shoulders and he hits the one-winged angel and got the win. Not the brightest idea to take a guy who looked like he was concussed and give him a one-winged angel and drop him on the back of his head. I'm not sure about the judgment on that one. Far be it from me to make a judgment against somebody like Kenny Omega, who's a pro and knows what he's doing in there. But I was cringing watching this, and I was thinking, man, that can't be good. That is not good. But up until the point that Evil got knocked silly, they had a damn good match. And Evil was back, I don't know if it was the next night or a few nights later, so... I would sit here and say that obviously he wasn't hurt or he wasn't hurt that badly, but things in Japan are very different. You know, I don't know that New Japan has concussion testing the way WWE does and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, you know what? He probably was concussed, and over there, they don't give a fuck. It's right back out there the next night because that's what those guys do. There were two big upsets in the tournament on day 14, which was yesterday. Juice Robinson pinned Kenny Omega. He escaped the one-wing angel, turned it into a small package, and got the pin. The best part of this was Juice's reaction and how, and the crowd reacted too. The crowd was giving this guy, you know, a huge ovation. So they were really happy for him getting the win here and probably also very surprised to see Kenny Omega take the loss. But Juice's reaction, he was so happy to pick this win up. He couldn't believe it. The other big upset, and I haven't actually seen the match yet because I'm a little bit behind, so I can't comment on it other than to say that Evil beat Okada. And again, Evil doing well enough after the match with Omega. Obviously, he's able to go out there and wrestle at a high level, because from what I heard, the match that he and Okada had was tremendous. Now, next Saturday is the big Kenny Omega Kazuchika Okada rematch, match number 3 in the series between the two of them. And then a week from today, next Sunday morning, are the G1 finals. This thing comes to a climax. Well, no pun intended. It comes to a climax from, Sumo Hall. It'll be airing live at 2 a.m. Eastern with English commentary on New Japan World. Hopefully I'll have a chance to watch that match before I record episode 508 next Sunday. But the G1 rapidly coming to a conclusion very soon. I've enjoyed everything I've seen. I haven't seen every match, but all the G1 stuff I've seen has been no less than good, if not great. It's the best wrestling in the world for these 4 weeks. And now we have some big matches like Omega Okada coming up this week, plus whatever the finals turns out to be. Seems like they're probably saving the best for last. Let's get to some mailbag questions. If you have them, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Jim from Marlton, New Jersey. Not based on storyline progression, but purely match quality. Buy or sell on the best WWE main event all week. The Triple Threat match from Raw, the Cena Nakamura match from SmackDown, or the Aleister Black Kyle O'Reilly match from NXT. I'm going to buy an O'Reilly in black from NXT. That was the best match I saw all week on WWE television. It was not the best match I saw all week, period, because some of the matches I saw on Lucha Underground were better. And even, I forgot which one, but one of the matches from the G1. There's a lot of good wrestling this week. A lot of good wrestling. But as far as WWE goes, I got to buy on the NXT main event. David from Westland, Michigan. How come the original match between Bret Hart and Psycho Sid was changed to Bret Hart and Steve Austin at the In Your House pay-per-view in April of 1997? It seemed better with Sid seeking revenge on Bret for costing him the title at WrestleMania 13. I had forgotten that they had made the match with Bret and Sid before changing it to Bret and Austin. But you are right. They did, in fact, announce that. That was going to be the match. I know Sid was in a pretty bad car wreck that year, but I think that happened in the summer. And then he was gone after that. So this just sounds like a plans change kind of situation. I don't think it was a case of Sid pulling a power play or something like that, which made no sense because he would have been in a high-profile match, and as it turned out, he wasn't on the pay-per-view at all, I don't think. So I'm not 100% sure. He was back on TV a few weeks later. It just sounds like they decided to go in a different direction and they had to wait to come up with something else for him to do. This one comes from Teak Vaughn. As we all know, there were many missed opportunities in the WCW invasion angle. But unlike most people, my main gripe, was the lack of cruiserweights. Like Alex Wright, La Parca, Yuji Nagata, etc. They brought a ton of personality, and with a roster that already had the likes of RVD, Jeff Hardy, Christian, and Chris Jericho, the amount of potential for a revamped cruiserweight division would have been huge. How would you have felt about more cruiserweights in the Alliance? Cruiserweights in the Alliance, I think, would have been the wrong way to go. I mean, for the invasion to work right out of the gate, you needed the big names. You didn't need Yuji Nagata or Alex Wright or Disco Inferno. I mean, you never need Disco Inferno, but you needed the big names right out of the gate. Had they done it the way, you know, that I've mentioned before, I've done some fantasy booking about how I would have done the invasion and stuff, and I understand that they couldn't get every single person. There were financial reasons and what have you, but they certainly could have made more of an effort to bring in some of those guys. They all ended up coming in anyway, including Bischoff. That's what kills me about the whole thing. They got every single one of those guys, except Luger. But they got every single one of those names in the end anyway. Steiner and Bischoff and Goldberg and Flair and, you know, if they just would have felt a greater sense of urgency to bring at least some of those guys in quicker, I think things would have turned out a lot differently. But, you know, we ended up getting Booker T and Buff Bagwell. And that's no fault of Booker T. But we got Booker and Bagwell on that one Raw show in Tacoma. Were it not for that, I think that they would have pushed ahead with the plans that they already had for WCW to be its own brand, and that's where you bring in the cruiserweights, to answer your question. You could build you could build that division around Rey Mysterio. And there's another name that eventually came in, although that wasn't until... When did... Actually, Rey came in the same year that the NWO did. I mean, Hogan, Hall, and Nash were in at the beginning. I think by the summer, Rey was in, right? Because Rey had that match at SummerSlam with Kurt Angle. So, yeah, Rey came in not long after also. But I think you bring in Rey, and you can build around Rey Mysterio at first, right? I know he was already wrestling heavyweights in WCW there at the end, but he was also the face of that cruiserweight division. I think people associated him with that division for a very long time. And he was a name that people recognized. You build around him for a little bit. You bring in guys like Juventud, who eventually came in as part of the Mexicools. You bring in Juventud. You bring in Ultimo Dragon, who they did bring in as part of their light heavyweight division. Didn't work out too well for him there. Kidman. Shane Helms. After a while, you can transition Rey away from the cruiserweights. And by that point now, you're talking 2002, right? You sign some new faces. You sign guys like AJ Styles, who was around back then. In fact, I think AJ had a brief stint in WCW there at the end. Bring in AJ Styles. Bring in Bryan Danielson. I'm sure he would have fit right in there in the cruiserweight division at that time. These are guys who were all coming up around that time, 2001, 2002, and they would have fit in perfectly in that cruiserweight division. And eventually they, you know, would have moved beyond the cruiserweight stuff the way that Chris Jericho did and Eddie Guerrero did. But there never should have been an alliance. I think that's really the point here. The alliance never should have been a thing. It should have been an invasion of big names and some mid-card guys. You got to have mid-card guys, right, to take the losses in the matches if you're going to do an interpromotional thing. But you start out that way. You make the WCW guys a big deal. You don't tear them down. You make them out to be a big deal. Especially if your plan was to give them Monday Night Raw. That's one of the things I will never understand. And, I mean, it's been backed up. I mean, Jim Ross was part of all that planning that was going on behind the scenes at the time with Vince and everyone else. I mean, there were plans in motion to make WCW its own separate brand. And, you know, they were this close to it. And to give... the Raw slot, I mean, maybe they would have called it Nitro, but to give the Raw spot to them and let the WWF guys do their thing on SmackDown on Thursdays. Vince, the one thing it shows me is that Vince McMahon was at one point serious about making this thing work. He's not giving WCW his baby, right? His prime flagship spot on Monday nights, unless he really wants this thing to be a success. So at least for a period of time, before the match in Tacoma happened, he was serious about making this thing work. Now, would it have worked? I don't know. I don't know that it would have worked. You know, Raw may have gone right back with the WWF guys in that spot 6 months later, for all we knew. They had already preconditioned and trained their audience to hate WCW. WCW was the enemy. Why are we going to watch these guys? Why are we going to root for them when... for years, you told us to hate them. They tried to put us out of business. They were inferior to the WWF guys. That's the problem for all those years with the war that was going on, with constantly, you know, trying to drill that idea into people's heads that we're better and they're inferior. Is that now when they come in, you know, it's hard for the fans to sort of let that go. But one bad match blew the whole thing. Dustin from Barberville, Kentucky. Do you know the reason why Rick Rude was never WWF champion? Did Vince feel he was not a draw? And do you believe that he deserved to be WWE champion? I don't know what Vince's rationale was. If he did, I don't think that it was a case of him not thinking Rude couldn't have been a draw. I just think the timing just didn't make any sense. Hogan was the champ, and Hogan put the Warrior over at WrestleMania that year. That was in 1990. And so the Warrior was now the guy. And he didn't want to take the title off the Warrior until he finally realized that this ain't working. And then they did take the title off Warrior, but that wasn't until 91. And by that point, Rude was already out or on his way out of the company. So I don't know that... Rude never really had the chance to show that he could draw, right? So I don't buy that as being the excuse. I just think either he didn't see him as being at that level, or... it was more just a matter of timing. Warrior is our guy, and we're not taking the belt off him. And in fact, he used Rude for the opposite reason. He used Rude to make the Warrior stronger and to help make his title run a success by having him, you know, beat Rude in that cage match at SummerSlam in 1990. Rude was just a speed bump for the Ultimate Warrior, and that's how Vince looked at him. I know that, not because I asked Vince McMahon myself, but because I have, you know, two eyeballs that worked, and I watched it myself. It's right there in front of your face. I mean, you can probably put the pieces together on your own and figure out how he viewed Rick Rude. Now, did Rick Rude deserve a run as WWE champion? Looking back on it, you know, deserve, again, it's a funny word, deserve, but I would have liked to have seen him get a run with it. I think he was a great heel. You know, he's a good wrestler, took great bumps and all that, and he can make other people look like a million bucks, which, again, we've seen with other people, like a Ziggler could also be your downfall, because if they look at you and they say, hey, yeah, this guy is really good at making other people look good, that could end up biting you on the ass, right? Now, Shawn Michaels is an example of a guy who made other people look good and bumped around all over the place, but he had a pretty good career for himself. But you could probably find a bunch of other people over time who fit that same, you know, a good bump taker makes others look good, and that could work against them. Maybe that worked against Rude also, I don't know, but yeah, I would have liked to have seen him with the championship, and I think he would have done very well for himself. I think he would have been a really good WWE champion. And then he could have lost it back to the Warrior, he could have lost it to Hogan or whoever, you know, put the big baby face over in the end, it would have been inevitable. I don't know how long of a run he would have had with it, but I would have liked to have seen him get a shot. I feel the same way about Mr. Perfect, frankly. And maybe the two of them cancel each other out. Maybe you can only pick one over the other. Maybe the real question is, who would I have liked to have seen around that same period, 1991, get the shot as the heel to run with the championship? Rick Rude or Mr. Perfect, who were best friends, by the way, which is kind of funny. That's a better question. And that's a tougher question for me to answer. I was always a huge Mr. Perfect fan. I was a bigger Mr. Perfect fan than I was a Rick Rude fan. I'm looking back at it now through different eyes, obviously, than I was when I was a kid. Rude looked the part more, if that makes sense, right? He looked like a million bucks. He was a little bit bigger. I think he was a little bit taller than Perfect. But I guess size-wise was, they weren't too far off from each other. They were both managed by Bobby Heenan. There's a lot of similarities between Mr. Perfect and Rick Rude when you really look at them side by side. If I had to pick one over the other, and who do I think would have had the better success in the role? That's a really difficult question for me to answer. I don't think you could go wrong with either one of them. I probably would give the nod to Perfect just because I was such a big fan of his and that Mr. Perfect character. And I think I might give him the edge on promos, but you can't go wrong with either one. And another similarity between them, both Intercontinental Champion. But I think in both those guys, they could have easily been WWE Champion. Absolutely. And look at Rick Rude in WCW. I mean, to me, that's an even bigger endorsement of the guy, and the fact that he could have worked, he could have succeeded, I think, in the role as champion for Vince, because he went to WCW and he became a world champion there, and he had, you know, great matches with Sting and Ricky Steamboat, you know, pay-per-view main event level matches. He went and became a headliner in WCW, and I think he did very well. In fact, that's a period of WCW that people look back on with great fondness, and the Dangerous Alliance and all that kind of stuff. Still, you know, the greatest War Games match that they ever did. So I know I kind of altered your question a little bit there, but I think that's probably the better question. Is I think that Perfect and Rude both should have had the shot, and I think they both would have done well in that spot. But if only one of them could get it, you know, maybe it's my own personal bias toward the guy, I probably would have given the nod to Perfect. But you couldn't go wrong with either one. Smarky Mark from Knoxville, Tennessee. Can you shed any light on the time Coco Beware beat the hell out of a jobber in Memphis? In watching the video, he looks legitimately pissed off and stiffs the guy beyond belief. Have you seen it? And if so, what is the backstory to this? You know, I just saw that video this week for the first time. That clip must be going around on Twitter or something, because that's where I saw it. I wish I knew the backstory behind it. I don't. For those of you who have no idea what he's talking about, Coco Beware, who at the time was just Coco Ware, was wrestling at a TV taping in Memphis. I forget which promotion, but it was in Memphis. This would have been before he came to WWE. And I think he came to WWE, had to be what, late 86 probably? Early 87 is when he came in. So this would have been before that, maybe 85-ish. He comes out for a match with this masked guy called the Patriot. Not to be confused with Del Wilkes. Okay, this was most definitely not Del Wilkes. You look at them side by side, they're not the same person. Coco gets in there. And right away, you could sort of tell something's a little off about him. The bell rings, they lock up, the Patriot gives him a chop in the corner. That would be his only offensive move for the entire match, because from that point on, Coco lit his ass up with stiff shots. He punched him, he kicked him, he walked on him. Literally, he walked on him at one point. And he gave this guy one of the stiffest clotheslines that you'll ever see. He knocked the guy out with the clothesline. I know it's hard to tell because he's wearing a mask, but I'm telling you, the guy was knocked out. You could see the guy's arms go limp. Coco goes to pick him up. The guy couldn't even move. When he does finally start moving, he barely has any strength in his arms to push up off the mat. Then he gives the guy a brain buster. And then comes the best part of the entire thing. He covers him. And while Coco is pinning him, I think the ref counts one. He then slaps the snot right out of this guy. Just smacked him as hard as he could right across the face, like to wake him up. Like he knew he was knocked out. He wasn't all there. Hey, let me wake you up. Wham, right across the face. He pins him. Bell rings. Coco just leaves the ring. Like, my business is done here. I'm out of here. I don't know if the guy used a racial term on him in the back before the match. Maybe the guy was full of himself in the back and Coco wanted to teach him a lesson. Whatever it was, it had to be something serious because I have never seen this side of Coco Beware before. Even the announcers, if you listen to the announcers, and I think it might have been Lance Russell and the other guy, but they sounded surprised, I think would be a good word for what they sounded like here watching this match. They were surprised to see Coco this in this way here in this match. So I'm sorry I don't have a better answer for you as far as why he did what he did, what may have happened, you know, before the match. But if you've never seen the match before, there's a couple of versions of it up on YouTube. Check it out if you want to see strong style Coco Beware. It's the best way I could put it, as opposed to Birdman Coco Beware. Cameron from Sydney, you've mentioned you were a fan of the Ninja Turtles. Were you ever a fan of Captain Planet? My only exposure to Captain Planet is the Robot Chicken skit where Ted Turner plays Captain Planet, and he has one of the best catchphrases I've ever heard. So, like, again, it's like a 3 or 4 minute skit. If you've never seen Robot Chicken, it's like claymation. But it's part of the Adult Swim block, or at least it used to be. I don't even know if it's still on anymore. But Ted Turner, they're like in the boardroom, he's talking to his people, and something's going on with the environment, and he's like, he takes matters into his own hands, and he goes into the bathroom, and he's smearing the makeup on his face, and Ted Turner becomes Captain Planet. He's the savior of the environment. At the end of the skit, he just goes, "Protect the environment or I'll fucking kill you." And I'm just thinking to myself, that's a great catchphrase for a superhero. So that's it. That's my only exposure to Captain Planet. I mean, was it a real thing? I assume it must be based off something. I know Harvey Birdman, when that show was on, Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law, I became a big fan of that. I wasn't aware that the Harvey Birdman character was like an aborted cartoon character from like the 1960s that never went anywhere. You know, there's been so many of them. I'm sure Captain Planet was one of them, but that's my exposure to Captain Planet was from the Robot Chicken skit. John from Oceanport, New Jersey, with SummerSlam coming up in 2 weeks, I thought of two big matches that happened in the last 5 years, both non-title matches. So buy or sell on which SummerSlam match was the best in the last 5 years? CM Punk versus Brock Lesnar from 2013, or John Cena versus AJ Styles from last year's show? I was in attendance for that match last year, and I think it's the best match I have ever seen live. Well, I was there for that show as well. I won't be at SummerSlam this year, but I was at that show at Barclays last year, and it's hard for me to vote against it, but I'm going to. I'm going to buy on CM Punk and Brock Lesnar from 2013. I'm going to sell on AJ Styles and John Cena. Both matches were a lot of people's match of the year winner for their respective year. I know Punk and Lesnar was my match of the year in 2013. I think I had Cena and Styles in my top. I definitely had their match at SummerSlam in my top 10 matches for last year. I want to say I had them at number 3 or 4 on that list, I think. That was a great match. Lots of dramatic near falls, great crowd, great energy in the building for that match. A shocking finish. I mean, say what you want to about John Cena, but he has lost clean a bunch of times now to a bunch of different guys, and when he does, it means something. Because he has the reputation, oh, yo, Super Cena, and being someone who always wins. The fact is, he lost clean to Daniel Bryan. He lost clean to Kevin Owens in Owens' very first pay-per-view match. He lost clean to AJ Styles. And just this week, he lost clean to Shinsuke Nakamura. And that's an even mix of heels and babyfaces. That's not all babyfaces. That's like two babyfaces and two heels at the time when he lost to them. And he should at this point. Cena's 40 years old. He's got 1 foot out the door. You know, he gets compared a lot to Hulk Hogan, who's the biggest star in the history of that company. When Hogan came back in 2002, he lost constantly. He lost to The Rock. He lost to The Undertaker. He tapped out to Kurt Angle. He lost to Brock Lesnar in a bear hug. If Steve Austin wasn't hurt, if Steve Austin wrestled another 5 or 10 years, he would have been expected to do the same thing and put the younger guys over. So him losing last year to AJ the way he did was a pretty big deal. They did the right thing. I didn't know if they had it in them to do it, honestly, but they did. And after that, Styles went on to win the WWE title. He became the face of SmackDown, as he should have. Here's hoping they do the same thing with Nakamura and they don't squander a clean win over John Cena. I know that's way beyond what you were asking me, but Cena and Styles had a fantastic match, but Punk and Lesnar is still one of Brock's best matches, if not his best match, I think, since coming back to WWE. It wasn't just suplex, 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 5 minutes done or 10 minutes done. That match was every bit of what, 20, 25 minutes, I think? Of just no disqualification badassery. It was a fight, and I do think it shut a lot of people up who were bitching going into that match that they, oh, I can't take somebody like CM Punk seriously against a guy like Brock. Okay, not everybody. Some people still bitch about it, but Brock gave him a lot in that match, and he worked harder in that match than maybe any of the other matches he's been in, partially because it went so long. I mean, we don't see Brock in very many 20-minute matches anymore. He worked his ass off in that match. He gave Punk a lot. He made Punk look, you know, in a lot of ways like he was on his same level, even though he's not. You know, although now Punk, of course, Punk can also say now, hey, I'm a UFC fighter too, although it doesn't exactly mean the same thing. But, you know, Brock did give him a lot. And that match is a big part of why that SummerSlam show from 2013 is one of the best SummerSlams, I think, of all time, honestly. I think 2002 is up there. I mean, I might even be willing to say that overall the 2002 show maybe is the best SummerSlam. That could be number one. That show also had two fantastic main events, Shawn and Triple H, and then Rock and Brock. But if you ranked all of the SummerSlams, it's hard to see those two not being in the top five, 2002 and 2013. And that match was a big part of why. So we're going to end it there. I had a bunch of other questions that I was, you know, hoping to get to. I can't get to all of them today. I want to say thank you, though, for pushing us over 28,000 YouTube subscribers this week. Not bad for a channel that has exclusively bonus content. I want to hit 30,000, but I can't do it without you. I need your help to do it. I know a lot of you go to the channel and watch the videos but aren't subscribed. Please subscribe. YouTube.com/TheSolomonster. That is the official channel. You'll see the Sound Off Extra banner at the top. Please subscribe there. You get all the post-pay-per-view reviews, including there'll be one for SummerSlam coming up in a couple of weeks. special interviews like the one I just did with Justin Roberts, gamer videos, crate unboxings. I got another one to do here. Pretty much anything outside of the regular podcast goes up on that channel, and sometimes some bonus surprise stuff that you may not expect. So try to help get us up to 30,000. Go there and subscribe. I also did my first Periscope on Twitter yesterday from the hotel I was at. I was on the road at a wedding. People seemed to enjoy it. It went well enough, and so we'll probably do more of those in the future. They'll be random, so the only way to know about them, I'll tweet before I go live. So follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. I know there's also Facebook Live, and I think Instagram has something similar, but let's not overwhelm me here. I should probably make more use of my Instagram. One step at a time. One step at a time. I'll get there in due time. Just be patient with me. And that's it. That's episode 507 for this week. I will be back for Sound Off episode 508. Next weekend, I believe we have, is it two more shows, I think, before SummerSlam, I believe. Right, so I will do, if the NXT TakeOver show is not this upcoming Saturday, but the following Saturday, I will probably do NXT TakeOver Brooklyn predictions next week. So, yes, we will do those predictions next week, SummerSlam predictions the following week. It's coming up quick. And that means there's going to be a lot of content going up. So now's as good a time as any to subscribe and keep listening to the show. Keep spreading the word. I appreciate all of your support, whether it is just word of mouth, supporting the show, PayPal donations, Audible signups, t-shirts. We have two new ones up. Check those out. I am the Solomonster. I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend, episode 508. So until then, be well, stay safe, and have yourselves a fantastic week. We'll see you next time. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, "Wait, aren't you going to put any pants on?" He just goes, "No time for pants," and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. You see, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.